It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward, in for Kate Archer-Kent. A new report from the insurance company Sedgwick found companies recalled more than 900 million product units, from cars and bicycles to pharmaceuticals and smartwatches, in just the first 3 months of the year. And while food recalls initiated by the Food and Drug Administration declined by more than 12%, the average size of each recall skyrocketed as regulators in the U.S. ramped up enforcement activity and scrutiny over a range of industries. Companies are now on track to break through more than a billion units recalled for just a third time in more than 10 years. Join in on the reasons behind those increases and the role the pandemic played in the uptick. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Caitlin Wowak is a professor of operations management at Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame. Caitlin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
What do you think is causing the nation's recent uptick in recalls?
There can be so many factors at play here, stringent regulations, but a big one that's likely driving a lot of these recalls is COVID-19. We've seen so many recalls, like you mentioned, upticking in the last year or so, even the beginning of this year. And what is the big factor that's happened in the last few years? COVID-19. So although there hasn't been any large scale longitudinal studies that have conclusively said that, a lot of people are pointing in that direction.
Well, what is the decision-making process that goes into deciding if a product needs to be recalled? Take me through it.
Absolutely. So this is a process that isn't very transparent to consumers. So every company has their own unique processes. So I'll kind of talk about the general process that most companies go through when they make a product recall decision. So government agencies like the FDA, they're responsible for making sure that products are available to consumers that are safe and high quality. But companies have the ultimate responsibility to ensure that the products that they're producing, they're distributing, are high quality and safe for consumers. So they will have teams of people whose sole job is product quality and assurance to make sure that they have high quality products. So these teams will gather information from internal sources, such as product testing and resource and development, and external sources like consumer complaints, to kind of help them monitor what's going on with product quality to see if there's any potential product problems that could be at play here. And they're more in the accumulation information stage. If it becomes apparent that there could be a potential product quality issue for one of their products, they will then begin a recall investigation to determine, is this just random variability in the manufacturing process, or do they actually have a systematic underlying issue that warrants a product recall? If it looks like it's just random variation at the end of the recall process, that's it. The company keeps producing the product. There's no recall that's initiated by the company. If it looks like there could be a systematic issue at play here, a recall committee is typically convened that consists of executives from various departments across the organization, such as research and development, manufacturing, legal, quality, and they review all the available information and then determine if a recall is warranted. If so, what is the scope of the product recall? Is it just a few lot codes? Is it the entire product line? Is it all products that are made from, you know, Monday to Friday? Kind of what are we talking about in regard to the scope of the product recall? And then they will submit all of that information and make a formal recommendation to the appropriate VP, the vice president, who is typically the vice president of quality. The company will then notify the government agency that they work with, you know, maybe the FDA if it's a food product or, you know, a pharmaceutical product. And then at that point, the recall has begun. So it's a complex process. Mm-hmm. How quickly a firm will go through this process really depends on the company's culture and their individual processes. But that's the general process that most companies go through.
Thank you. We have Christina on the line from Glenwood City with a question. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I purchased a product to be consumed, and then there was a recall on it. I never ate it. And so we emailed the company, and they never responded to us. So I'm wondering, how long do we have to get a refund when it is through a recall? And any suggestions on how to go forward with this?
Thanks, Christina. What do you say to that? She's having a hard time getting the company to respond.
That's a really, really good question. So you did exactly what you should have done. You emailed the company, you communicated that you have a recall product. What I would do is I would take that back to the retailer that you purchased the product from, if that's local for you, whether that be Target or Costco or Walmart, and then they should give you a refund for the product. That's what I would recommend.
Okay. Thanks, Christina. I appreciate that. That's, I think, a very common thing that happens to folks. I'm curious about pushback from companies. You know, a lot of this responsibility lies with the company, as you said. But I'm thinking about Peloton in particular. When their Tread and Treat Plus treadmills were recalled last year, there were some safety concerns there. The company initially refused to comply with the government's push for a recall. The company later issued a voluntary recall. But why do some companies kind of resist that initially?
That is a really very good question. So product recalls are incredibly expensive for companies. You have tangible implications, the financial cost of issuing product recalls, replacing the defective products. You have the intangible cost of, you know, people knowing that their product had a major product quality issue. But in the long term, it is always the best interest of the company to issue a product recall when in doubt there's an issue at play here. So Peloton really pushed back. In the long term, they probably cost themselves some more consumer damage, reputational damage, by not adhering to the recall that was recommended for them. So that there's a lot of competing factors, but in the long term, companies have to protect consumers. They have to make products that are high quality and are safe for our consumers. And if a government agency comes to them and recommends a recall, of course, it is on their responsibility to investigate the situation, make sure it is their product that is defective. Obviously, in Peloton's case, there wasn't any, you know, other additional sources that could have been at play here, or companies that could have been at fault. And they should have issued a recall, which they eventually did. Sometimes when you have food product recalls, it could look like a product or a component is at fault here, but I have had stories before where companies came and said, we were notified that it was a product quality issue with our product. After further investigation, they found out it wasn't their product actually, or their component at fault. It was a different ingredient within that food product. So companies obviously should do a recall investigation, even if a government agency comes to them and says, you have a product quality issue. But when it's recommended to them, they should follow through with it for sure.
We're talking about how product recalls work with Caitlin Wolak. She's a professor of operations management at Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration can issue three types of recalls, class 1, 2, and 3. What's the difference between them?
Yeah, so class 1 recalls are the most severe product quality issues. These are the ones that are going to impact consumer health. They can even result in consumer death, depending on what the underlying issues are. So those are the recalls you really want to pay attention to. Class 2 recalls are the moderately severe ones. These are ones that are going to cause temporary but reversible consumer impact. And class 3 recalls are the least severe ones. So class 3 recalls have no impact on consumer well-being, but technically, according to FDA guidelines, they do violate manufacturing regulations. So it could be more cosmetic issues on the product, or if you have, you know, a different labeling issue on the package versus the product inside of the package. So technically, these products do have to be recalled, but they do not have impact on consumer well-being.
Caitlin Wolak is a professor of operations management at Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame. Join in this discussion, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. We're talking about product recalls, from peanut butter to pharmaceuticals, electric vehicles, and more. As a report from the insurance company Sedgwick found, companies doing business in the United States are on track to recall a record number of products this year. Join in on the impact to consumers and the process regulators use to ensure product safety. 800-642-1234. 1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Caitlin Wolak is a professor of operations management at Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame. Your research found that adding women to company boards led to quicker recalls for some dangerous medical products. How do company boards affect how product recalls are made?
Yes. So there's been quite a few research on women diversity in other fields, but this was the first study that looked at gender diversity and the upper echelons within organizations on operational issues. So this has been a really impactful study and probably one of the coolest studies I've ever worked on before. But the board of directors is the highest level within an organization that oversees the top management, the TMT. And the TMT is the level within the organization that typically makes recall decisions. So what we theorize in this study is that the board of directors, they set the tone for how decisions should be made. Are they making recall decisions really focusing on the bottom line? How much is this going to financially cost the company? Or are they making it with a broader perspective of who are the consumers impacted? Who are the organizational stakeholders that are impacted by recall decisions? So in this paper, we theorize that when you have more women on your board of directors, the company, the TMT, the top management team, makes different recall decisions because women set the tone that you need to really focus on different organizational stakeholders. Women who end up on the board of directors typically have more diverse backgrounds than their male counterparts on the board of directors, who typically come up from within the organization and have a lot of business background. So we theorize that they make different decisions. And when they have high severity, the class one recalls that I mentioned earlier, when companies have women on the board of directors, they issue those class one recalls about 28 days faster, or 35% reduction in recall timing. We also found some interesting insights in regard to the low severity product quality issues, the class two and three recalls that I mentioned earlier. When women are on the board of directors, firms recall about 120% more class three recalls than if firms have all male boards. And we attribute that to the fact that women in general typically follow rules and might set a more rule-following tone within the organizations they oversee.
That's so interesting. You also studied the effect of product competition in the U.S. pharmaceutical industry and its relationship with product recalls. What did you learn there?
Yes. So what we looked at over a long period of time is that when you have more product competition in the pharmaceutical industry, companies compete differently. So there was an act in 1984. It's typically known as the Hatch-Waxman Act, which it was designed to increase product competition for pharmaceutical products with the intention of lowering prices for consumers, which we all want as consumers. But when you have more product competition, companies typically have to compete on maybe one or two strategies. And one strategy can be producing the highest quality products and charging a premium. That is not always a beneficial strategy when talking about generic drugs or pioneer original drugs, because in consumer minds, they all have the same quality, the same product quality. So a lot of consumers would prefer the cheaper drug in that context because it's a bioequivalent drug and it's intended to do the same thing as a pioneer drug. So what companies will often do when there's more product competition is they will compete on cost. So lower, you know, trying to undercut their competition by producing the lowest available product at a cost base. And when you cut costs, you typically have to absorb those cost-cutting strategies within your manufacturing process. You can buy cheaper quality inputs, delay service on your equipment to kind of spread out the cost there. You might cut quality control or assurance practices because that's also a cost in the manufacturing process. And when you're really focusing on cost cutting, sometimes a byproduct of that is lower quality products.
We're talking about the factors that affect when and how products are recalled with Caitlin Wolak. She's a professor of operations management at Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame. Your academic research has long looked at supply chain management and supply chain resiliency. I don't know about you, but I mean, I feel like I've heard more about supply chain issues in the last couple of years than I had in my entire life. So what's the pandemic teaching you about supply chain resiliency, something that you didn't know beforehand?
Absolutely. You are not alone in that. I often have people say, we didn't know what supply chain management right. was or supply chains before the pandemic. And unfortunately now, most of the time, they don't have the supply chain in the positive light because you have long delays for products or, you know, a lot of potential quality issues at play here. But we have learned quite a bit from COVID-19 in regard to supply resilience. So a lot of firms before COVID-19 were really focused on efficiency. And that often looked like just-in-time manufacturing process, lean operations. You know, these are buzzwords that people often talk about in regard to operations or supply chain management. But with the COVID-19, we have actually kind of swung the other direction where companies want to keep more inventory on hand. They want days of inventory on hand. So if their inventory coming from suppliers is delayed or they have inventory stuck at ports and it can't get unloaded like we saw, you know, before or after the pandemic, but a few months ago, they're keeping a lot more safety stock and inventory on hand. They're increasing the number of suppliers that they can have for materials or inputs into their manufacturing process because suppliers have had really difficult times weathering the COVID-19 pandemic with employees out or manufacturing processes, you know, having inventory stuck in ports that you can't get in order to supply your up tier supply chain partners. Also kind of looking at alternative logistical paths. So how many routes can you take to move your products into the United States or get them to the different suppliers? We're learning a lot. So hopefully companies are engaging in post-disruption feedback to really focus on the lessons learned here to improve their operations moving forward.
And really looking forward, do you think manufacturers are learning from this? I mean, have they really had an eye-opening moment about what they need to do?
I really hope so. I believe that they have. I mean, they are kind of still in the pandemic. I mean, a lot of companies are still weathering the storm and getting their feet underneath them in regard to how to, you know, keep their operations going. But I think that they are learning a lot.
I know the U.S. is facing baby formula shortages, too. We're hearing a lot about that, in part because of a baby formula recall from Abbott in February. How do you think access to baby formula could be improved?
That is a really good question. That in particular was a very scary recall, especially for young parents, because you don't have an alternative product that you can use. If you use Jiffy peanut butter or Jif peanut butter and that's recalled, okay, there's Peter Pan peanut butter. There's other products available that you can use. That one in particular was very scary for young parents who had babies that had formula because you don't have any other options often. So having multiple suppliers for your inventory, having multiple manufacturing plants set up that can produce that inventory, and then changing the distribution routes to make it available in consumers in all parts of the world, those are going to be critical takeaways for companies with the critical products like the baby formula recall.
What are some of the top things that manufacturers really need to do to make sure that the supply chain is resilient in the future and can handle product recalls?
Having extra safety stock on hand so they can weather the storm when products are recalled to manufacture safe and wholesome products when they're pulling the defective products out of the market, really focusing on quality control and making sure that they have the culture within organizations to make proper recall decisions. The FDA, a lot of government agencies, they have oversight, but given the number of organizations that they see, they can't closely monitor every single firm. So it's really on the companies to make accurate and responsible recall decisions for their consumers.
And what do you think that companies could do to respond to, you know, the kind of that pressure to avoid negative consequences, avoid negative press? I mean, what do you say to those companies that have those concerns?
It oftentimes with recalls, it's part of the territory, but it always looks worse on the firm when they delay a product recall, when they sit on it. I mean, the classic examples that you talk about in the recall space is, you know, the Ford Pinto example. So when those situations come out, it makes the firm look even worse in the long term. When you have product recalls, the classic good one was the Johnson & Johnson one. Yes, they suffered in the short term when they recalled the Tylenol recall, which was a massive recall back in the day. But in the long term, they actually became kind of the shining star in how you handle product recalls because they were efficient. they did the right thing. They pulled every product until they had an idea of what to do. So doing the right thing, responding quickly, and being very communicative with your consumers will help you weather the storm. And in the long term could actually make you, you know, more positive and consumer liked.
I want to thank you for this conversation. It has been absolutely fascinating.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Ahead this hour, we delve into life in Afghanistan 1 year after the U.S. withdrawal from the country with a professor of politics at Oxford University. Caitlin Wowak, professor of operations management at Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame. Thanks again for being here. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. News Update is next on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward. 1 year ago this month, the Taliban captured Kabul, capping the fall of Afghanistan's U.S.-backed government. America's longest war ended as Islamist militants that had been chased from power in 2001 were once again back in command. More than 124,000 people were airlifted from the country, but tens of thousands of Afghans who aided the U.S. effort were left behind. Join in on the consequences of the Taliban takeover and its impact on the people of Afghanistan 1 year later. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nita Crawford is the Montague Burton Professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations with Oxford University. She also co-directs the Costs of War Project with Brown University. Professor Crawford, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
I'm happy to be with you.
Join in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. It has been more than a year since the American withdrawal from Afghanistan. What is life like in the country now under Taliban rule?
Well, after getting abysmal, it's slightly improved over the last few months. And what I mean by abysmal is that there was rampant inflation, loss of international support, meaning there was little money flowing into the country. And there was chaos because the Taliban government wasn't really governing in a systematic way. So it has gotten a little better.
Just in recent months?
Yes, I would say the last quarter.
How?
But in overall, the situation is very, very bad.
How are conditions different in the country since the American withdrawal, and what are some of the factors? You mentioned some of them. What are some of the other factors that are contributing to those issues?
Well, the first major difference is who's in charge, or actually sort of semi in charge. And what I mean by that is the governing of Afghanistan, which was tenuous at best at times under the previous government, which was backed by the U.S., is much more fractured. It's more localized. And its concentration of power now in Kandahar rather than Kabul. And that means that they're having a coherent strategy to meet the other challenges that Afghans are facing is very difficult. So what are those other challenges? I mean, the first one is lack of international support. Now, when the Taliban took over, the international community said, no, we're not going to fund you. And for the average Afghan, that has meant a dramatic decline in standard of living. Now, most of the people in Afghanistan are hungry. Many live on one meal a day. And it's extremely expensive to buy basic things. There's been inflation, dramatic inflation, up to 50%. We think inflation is bad. Here, it's much worse there. So that economic and humanitarian collapse is dire for the average Afghan. 97% of the people in Afghanistan are food insecure and facing famine. So the political, the humanitarian, and the economic crises are a sort of trifecta of bad. But as I say, it's getting a little bit better because international organizations like the International Rescue Committee and some smaller organizations have been in there trying to help people. And then the Afghan people themselves are pooling resources and working to make their condition better. So overall, though, I would say that it's much worse. And then we could talk about the consequences of the war. The wars, are really ongoing with ISIS, ISIS-K. Mm-hmm. And that creates a level of instability and violence, which makes the life of the average Afghan, again, not good.
We're talking about life in Afghanistan a year after the country fell to Taliban rule with Nita Crawford. She's a professor of politics and international relations with Oxford University in the UK. The Taliban is restricting girls' education. They're only allowing boys to go to school beyond sixth grade. What effect is this having on women in the country?
Well, in the long run, it means that many girls will go into adulthood with little prospect of entering a job market where they have the right skills. They're not being let into the job market in any case. And I think it means a simmering resentment among the young women and girls who did get an education and who have been denied an education. As I say, however, individual Afghans are working in a clandestine way, or sometimes more or less openly, though, to make sure that girls continue to be educated. But overall, the decline in political freedom, the mobility for girls and women, and the dire economic straits that all families are under make life for women in Afghanistan very bad.
As we see more women's rights being curtailed there, I'm curious how the international community is responding to that. What are you hearing?
Well, there's the rhetorical response, which is basically, that's not okay. And then that's combined with a carrot and stick approach. If you, if the Afghan government, the Taliban government, were to loosen up, I think we'd see more aid. And there's always the carrot. That's the draw. And at one point, when the government overall was about to allow girls to go back to school, a sheikh in Kandahar said no. So that's the problem. There is no way for the entire Afghan people to weigh in on this because of the concentration of power. I think that the international community has very few levers, however, other than the possible resumption of large-scale assistance.
I remember reading about all of the talks that were taking place leading up to this when Afghanistan fell to Taliban rule. And I recall that the Taliban was assuring the world that it would be a more moderate force, that the world would not see, the kind of things that they feared. Has this last year shown that to be the case? I feel like there was kind of a collective eye roll that's not going to happen. But have they been more moderate?
I think that depends on specific locations, but overall, I would say no, because extrajudicial killing has occurred. That is, people are summarily killed who disagree. There's a suppression of free speech. And in most instances, you see people, if their speech is not suppressed, people are afraid. And they're hiding. So no, I would say that they did not relax, and there's still quite a bit of fear in the country. There was, I think the eye rolling was appropriate. But could this have gone another way? I don't know, actually. Could the international community have kept supporting the Taliban? Would they have been with greater international support able to feed people? Yes. Would they have been able to open up politically? I doubt it. I think that they're too afraid.
We see things from the outside looking in, but I'm curious what it's like for the people who live there. Do you think that the people of Afghanistan expected that the Taliban would be more moderate than they had been in the past? Do you think they have been surprised by what's happened in the past year?
You know, what I understand of what Afghans are thinking and feeling is obviously at a great remove. I don't talk to the average Afghan. I just read about their conditions from afar. And I believe there's both optimism and a sense of crisis. From what I understand, there's optimism that the work of non-governmental organizations and individual efforts at organizing will gradually make a difference. But, you know, it's very hard there when most people many people are only eating one meal a day, if that.
And is that the reality? They're eating one meal a day? Poverty is that prevalent?
Yeah, 43% of Afghans are eating one meal a day. 97% are living in conditions of poverty. From what I understand, this is a huge humanitarian crisis. And it is exacerbated in some ways by the lingering effects of 20 years of war, right? And the dire economic / humanitarian crisis is exacerbated by environmental distress. Long periods of drought, sometimes heavy rains. There was an earthquake a few months ago that caused a lot of damage, and people were not able to get in to help. So it's a very difficult situation there at a basic human level, yes.
Nita Crawford is the Montague Burton Professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations with Oxford University. Join in this discussion, 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. This month marks 1 year since the Taliban regained control in Afghanistan amid the U.S. military's withdrawal from the country. Since the takeover, policy experts and military officials continue to analyze what led to the fall of the U.S.-backed government while raising questions over the legacy of the war itself. Join in this discussion, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nita Crawford is the Montague Burton Professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations with Oxford University. She stays with us. The Taliban taking control raised questions about what led to what appeared on the outside to be a very chaotic and rushed withdrawal from the country. Was it as chaotic as it seemed? And if so, what went wrong with the American withdrawal from Afghanistan?
Well, I think the last few weeks were certainly chaotic and rushed, especially as the United States, the partners of the United States decided not to fight. And, you know, the Afghan military decided that it would be much more dangerous. I believe they did the calculation and said, if we fight, we don't have enough ammunition. If we fight, we don't have enough food. If we fight, then the Taliban will shell us. They've got the ammunition, and many civilians will die. And basically, I think that was a smart decision, realizing that the end was a fait accompli. The problem was that throughout the 20 years of the United States occupation of Afghanistan, two things didn't occur. First of all, a really good job preparing the Afghan military. And that the reason that didn't occur is complicated, including the fact that it was extremely dangerous to join the Afghan military for the simple reason that you might be attacked if you join the military or police, and your family would suffer retaliation. And then there was a lot of corruption in the military. The second thing that went wrong was a failure to develop a strong civil society / governance mechanism. And there were many Afghans who did an excellent job in providing their own health care and education. But overall, much of the resources that the United States spent in Afghanistan, the vast majority of it was for military force. That is, the U.S. occupation with its allies was extremely expensive. And when you compare that to the amount of money that went into, for instance, develop agriculture or education or healthcare infrastructure, it was minuscule. So in overall, the Afghan society was already weak. And I think we can say that the last few months were a mess. The withdrawal began, first of all, with Obama, then increased dramatically with Trump, and then basically the agreement that the United States reached in the Trump year, the final year of the Trump administration, was the one that Biden implemented. And the capacity was not there, actually, to do a good job. I just don't think that a good exit was in the cards, because the fundamental reality was not strong enough to support a good exit.
As you analyze this, do you see ways that this could have gone differently? Was there a point in which something could have changed the outcome here?
Well, there are many points. Politics is both driven by sort of fundamental things like underlying economics and relationships of power, military force. And it's also driven by individuals and, decision-making and leadership. And the fundamentals were from the United States invasion in 2001, not well done. So for instance, the United States, when it attacked in 2001, could have left and then supported a new regime. The Taliban was on the run and they were very weak. And the United States could have supported a new regime with massive economic support and developing the capacity of the people on the ground. And I think we would have had a much stronger civil society, able to be more robust and resilient. Okay, so we didn't do that. What's another turning point? Well, I think in 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, when the United States is engaged in a conversation with the Taliban, but the Afghan government wasn't there at the negotiations, that was a mistake. So the Afghan government had no part in what was to be an end to the war. And this weakened the Afghan government. So, bookending that are a lot of points when things could have gone better. Remember, the United States escalated in 2009 very dramatically with force. And again, that, killed a lot of people and looked like it temporarily worked. But as the U.S. military used to say, it was like playing whack-a-mole. So the fundamental error there, I think, is thinking that you can kill your way to a peace settlement, but not recognizing, though the U.S. military does actually recognize this at times, that when you hurt civilians along the way, that's counterproductive, and you diminish the likelihood that there will be a loss of support for insurgents, and you increase the recruitment attractiveness of insurgencies. So, it's basically, it was a mess from the get-go. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. We're talking about the legacy of the war in Afghanistan, a year after the country fell to Taliban rule, with Nita Crawford. She is a professor of politics and international relations with Oxford University. She is the co-director of the Costs of War Project with Brown University as well. The advocacy group No One Left Behind says at least 65,000 Afghans who worked for the American government or for contractors associated with the American military still remain in the country. What is happening to them?
I think many are in hiding and are trying to get out. There are extrajudicial killings in Afghanistan. Some are being killed. But I don't think we really know as much as we could know about the fate of those people. Some are on their way out and some are staying to try to create a better Afghanistan.
And that you thought to my question, I was going to say, how do we know? How do we know what's happening to those people?
Well, in a way, it's better that we don't know a whole lot because some of them need to make their way out, however, by whatever means, you know, maybe on foot, maybe on by automobile. You know, I don't know how they're getting out, and it's best we not.
Sure.
I really think that if people want to get out and they are determined, if they possibly can, they will try to do so. But I also think that, you know, the economic conditions there are so difficult that it's a struggle to live, you know, each day to get food, to make sure your family has food. People are selling whatever assets they have just to eat. I doubt that they're able to gather enough cash together, absent external assistance, to make a run for it, if that's what they want to do. They may be trying to continue to lay low. I think the main story in Afghanistan now is the humanitarian, economic, and political crisis, which is ongoing. Though, as I said, it's gotten a little bit better with less inflation in recent months.
You co-directed the Costs of War Project with Brown University. Last year, the project estimated that two decades of war post 9/11 had cost the U.S. $8 trillion, killed more than 900,000 people. Very briefly, in the 30 seconds we have left, what will the legacy of the Afghanistan war be in the U.S.?
In the U.S., it's a loss of opportunity to do the things that we could have done with that. Those trillions of dollars. The actual cost of the Afghanistan part of that was about looking into the future with the costs of healthcare, about $3 trillion. And the Iraq part is another large chunk. Mm-hmm. But so the legacy is in caring for veterans here and this huge amount of money we could have spent doing other things.
Nita, thank you so much for this fascinating discussion.
My pleasure.
Nita Crawford, the Montague Burton Professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations with Oxford University, also co-director of the Costs of War Project with Brown University. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.